David Morata, welcome back to the Shilling Show. You know, your visit is so timely today with all that's going on. It is a great time to have you here with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I wonder if we could talk about the debt ceiling first. I want to set the stage for our discussion, and many people may not understand what this debt ceiling is because they may have never encountered it personally.
Well, the debt ceiling is, we're one of the few countries that has a debt ceiling, and by law, we set a ceiling on our debt unless Congress acts to increase that. And currently, the debt ceiling was at $14.3 trillion. We've now blown through that with the new agreement, and I think it's up around $14.6 trillion already, and it continues to climb. Unfortunately, our speed with which we've been headed toward the debt ceiling has been increasing in recent years, and especially over the last 2 years, or 2.5 years, both the tail end of the Bush administration and then the Obama administration, it's continued to accelerate. And it's sort of like having a credit card limit. You can continue to use your credit card until you hit your credit card limit, and then your credit card stops working. Well, what we've done is we just continually vote ourselves to have a higher credit limit, and that credit limit's gone up by more and more. And I did some analysis. If you take all the people who pay federal income tax, there's about 111 million people who pay federal income tax. And if you take our debt and divide by that, we each have a personal debt of somewhere around $128,000 that's on our credit card, and that's our credit card limit.
When you say each, do you mean taxpayers?
Yeah, each taxpayer. Because
okay.
I'm assuming people who don't pay federal tax, even though they might pay other things, are really not going to be able to shoulder that burden. if you don't pay any federal income tax, you're usually in the lowest income tax brackets. And so it's the rest of us who are left with the burden of trying to pay off this debt.
I mean, it's almost unfathomable. We've seen reports recently about the net worth of people in America, and it's very, very low. And so even if you're paying taxes, it's not likely that you're going to be able to set that much aside extra in what you're already paying.
And what's worse is not only do we have $128,000 that we've run up on our credit card, but we're running up an additional $15,000 a year per taxpayer. So it's about $1,230 a month. And I can tell you, if anyone had an extra $1,230 a month, that's a lot of money. And to just be paying that to increase our debt every year is unsustainable.
Well, it is unsustainable, but we went forward with this deal, and we decided that we were going to increase the debt limit. Could we have just stopped and said, I'm sorry, no, which is what I thought we should have done, and maybe a lot of other people I heard calling for it wish would have happened?
We could have. It would have been quite a shock. We could have continued to make payments on our debt. We could have continued to pay Social Security payments out. We could have continued to pay all the active duty personnel. There's a number of things we could have done. The essentials of government would have continued. Because even when you hit your debt ceiling, you just can't add to your debt, but you continue to have revenues come in from the federal government, and now you just have to pay cash for everything you wanted. So in essence, it would have been an immediate balanced budget amendment that would say you have to live within your means. I've worked with a lot of families who get into credit card debt, and I can tell you that every family I have ever worked with that gets into credit card debt does not think they can reduce their lifestyle until it's too late and they have to reduce their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And it requires some kind of an incredible shock in order to do that. And we almost had that shock, and instead we got a debt deal.
Yeah, I wish we would have had the shock, because the shock is still going to come. It's just been delayed now, and it will be worse when it hits.
It's interesting, too, that one of the things that the debt deal shows is it shows that the house of cards of our spending without the debt ceiling being raised, without continuing to go further into debt, we can't continue to do all of this spending. So all of the things that everyone thought, oh, well, you know, the government has always done this and this is assured, we suddenly realize that we don't have the money to do that unless we continue to go further and further into debt. So there is no Social Security trust fund. There is no bank account somewhere. There's no lockbox somewhere. There's nothing that you've been paying into all of these years. All that money's been spent. And in fact, we continue to spend it and go further and further into debt. So it really does show that the spending spree that we've been on for the last decade is really a house of cards and needs to at some point come to an end.
Let's go to the phones very quickly, because David's been waiting for us. David, we don't have a lot of time, but you're on with David Morata.
Yes, I'll be quick. There are certainly many tangents to go off on this discussion today, which is great. And I think one of the more sobering statistics about the spending is if you took all of the 110 million entities that pay taxes today and doubled everyone's taxes, we would still be about $500 billion short of balancing the budget. So clearly what that says is there's got to be more emphasis on reducing spending as opposed to raising taxes. And I'll hang up and listen.
Hey, David, thank you. We've got about 30 seconds for a response, and we can pick it up on the other side if you like, David.
David is exactly right. Increasing taxes is not the problem. Spending is the problem. Increasing taxes is like trying to become more competitive by raising your prices. It just doesn't work.
And I want to get into this in a little bit more depth because that discussion is going on right now across the country. And we even see people in the daily newspaper writing letters about getting the rich to pay their fair share and let's just pillage the rich. I don't think that's the solution, but we're going to get David's opinion on that when the Shilling Show returns after this. Stay with us.
The Shilling Show is on the air. News Radio 1070 WINA.
News Radio 1070 WINA, you are with The Shilling Show. Hey, thanks for joining us weekdays from noon to 2. The phone number is 977-1070, or if you happen to be listening live online, and you know we're streaming the program now, you can pick it up anywhere in the world. You have a good internet connection. It's 434-977-1070. David Morata is our guest, and we're talking about the debt deal gone bad. We're talking about all of the problems that we're facing right now as a nation. And I wanted to pick up where we left off beforehand. And there was a question from listener David, and it had to do with, you know, how are we going to solve this? And is it really a spending problem or is it a revenue? Well, that's the word they use for taxation. We're just not taking in enough taxes. I look at this, Dave, and I say, if we give them more taxes, if we give them more revenue, they're just going to spend it. They've never proven that they can hold the purse strings. And if the money's there, it will be spent. Even if the money's not there, it will be spent. So why on earth would we give them one penny more?
The mantra seems to be somehow that the rich should continue to pay more. What's interesting is, and we've got a new blog, MoradaOnMoney.com, and I put a post up there that did an analysis. Revenue has been fairly constant between 15% and 20% of gross domestic product for 100 years. I mean, that the amazing thing about it is, you know, you go back and revenue seems to be constant, and that includes when the top marginal tax rate was 90%, mm-hmm. and when the top marginal tax rate was 35%. And in fact, now that the top marginal tax rate is 35%, we collect about the same amount in revenue, and yet the rich pay a bigger percentage, which is strange. But what it means is that top marginal rate simply holds back the most productive components of society. The way I think about raising taxes is it's like you're trying to become more competitive by raising prices. The problem is we have a global economy, and the United States businesses have to rent from the United States. So it's like we're tenants of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so the best contribution that our government can give us is to keep our rents low and give us more effective management. If they raise our rents, there's no way we can stay competitive in a global economy.
And so the issue is, does the government get more money or do people and businesses and corporations get more money? And what's more productive for the economy? Because I'm hearing this constant din from the left. We read it in the pages of the daily newspaper from people who are otherwise well-educated, but they appear to be economically ignorant, saying words to the effect of, if we just take more money from the people who are making it, then that will solve all of our problems. It seems to me, based on the information you just presented, that it won't. It just makes people less productive. And that is not a good solution.
And I think every single analysis, if you take a look at the countries with the most economic freedom and you look at their gross domestic product growth, there's a direct correlation between economic freedom, low taxes, low government intervention, and high growth. And it does not matter how far behind you are. If you have a 6.5% growth and your competitors have a 2-3% growth, you will outpace them and become a bigger economy at some point in the future. It's just a matter of time. And unfortunately, what we've done is we've changed from what used to be called the American style of growth, which is 6.5%, mm-hmm. and we've become more like Europe and the European malaise at 2.5%. And start with any numbers, grow one by 6.5% and one by 2-3%, and the 6.5% will become a bigger portion of the economy.
Yeah, it's just remarkable that we cannot learn from history. Instead, we seem to be embracing models of failure And we're certainly seeing the results of that. Let's go to the phones, and the phones are lighting up here. 977-1070 is the number. Leon stands by to take your call. Don't wait till the last minute to call in. Comments or questions for David Murata, challenges, we welcome your calls. And let's go to Gary. Gary, welcome to the Shilling Show. Thanks so much for calling, and you're on with David Murata.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for taking my call. David, I've got two questions for you. One is about tax credits, which, of course, you wrote about in your Monday column in the Charlottesville Business Journal. When we read in the daily newspaper and about tax credits issued by the Virginia Housing Development Authority, is that very similar to the tax credits with the conservation easements you wrote about?
That's a great question. There's three or four different tax credits you can get. Some are transferable and some are not. The housing tax credits are available. There's also neighborhood assistance programs for donations to charities. And then there, the tax credits that are transferable, you can just buy regardless of if you've had any qualifying event. But yes, all of those help to reduce your taxes. And any of those that you can get are good. The one I wrote about is ones that you can buy even if you don't have any historic homes or you haven't donated any land or you haven't put any land into conservation easement. You're just buying the tax credits from people who have, and that's a great way of reducing your tax bill.
Okay. David, the other question I have is this being thrown out again about quantitative easing. And what I don't understand is this. My understanding is, with these quantitative easing plans from the Federal Reserve Board, is they create their own checking account, of course. They create this money, and then they purchase Treasury obligations. Okay, all right, so they do that. Are the Treasury obligations then being held by the Federal Reserve? You see, I'm getting, I guess I'm not being able to complete the loop. Where does the money go? Is they're basically holding on those obligations? Until when? Until there's a good deal or until they can help the economy? Did you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, the Treasury can affect the money supply by buying or selling Treasury loans. So if they buy them, then they're buying them from someone and that puts money into the economy. And if they're selling them, then they're tightening up on the money supply. And the Fed used to do this to try to even out sort of the money supply. Money supply is sort of an older quantity. I think it was Milton Friedman who said all of those games that they play simply make matters worse. And if they just increase the money supply by about whatever the economy is growing at, and he suggested the economy at that point was growing by about 5%, he said just increase the money supply by about 5%, and that will provide the same liquidity and keep everything in keel, because they're usually trying to look in the rearview mirror and figure out what they're supposed to do. And then it got worse than that. Not only are they trying to look in the rearview mirror, they're trying to look in the forward mirror and get the current administration reelected and make everything look well. So I don't think the Fed has been our friend since the Great Depression, when they may have actually contributed to the Great Depression coming about. So there's a lot of economic activity that says what the Federal Reserve does is benign at best and harmful at worst, and probably more on the harmful end. And so when they're trying to pump dollars into the economy, again, it's this idea that you can bump up the economy by what government does. And most of the time, the economy grows by what government refrains and restrains themselves from doing in terms of interfering, because the market is smarter than the smartest central controller and the smartest central planner. And sometimes people ask, well, what are all the unintended consequences that you can't anticipate? And the whole point is there's unintended consequences that you can't anticipate. And all the efforts to try to anticipate whether quantitative easing is going to have a positive or negative effect, I would expect, because it's government intervention, it would have a negative effect. But what are all the negative effects it's going to have is very difficult to predict going forward. The market does a better job of that, of just reacting.
Gary, thanks so much for the call. That leaves a line open at 977-1070. David Murata is our guest here on The Shilling Show. Let's go to John. John, thanks for holding on. You're on with David Murata.
Hi, Rob. Hi, David. I was wondering if you could comment on something that you described in the last half hour about the inability of Americans to sort of understand where we are, and of their inability to to maintain our lifestyles the way that we want to without some shock coming down the road. And I would like you to pose the question in the form of here we are in Jefferson, Virginia, and if there was one adage that he left with us that, that is absolutely timeless and applicable to all cultures and all times, is that you can't expect to remain ignorant and free. And here we are in America, where we spend more per pupil on education than any other nation in the world, and yet kids graduating with MBAs and higher degrees are completely economically illiterate, and they actually believe that we can tax ourselves into prosperity. They believe all this economic gobbledygook, which is leading us exactly to the point where we're at right now, where nobody knows, can decipher what the heck kind of language is coming out of Washington, because we are basically rendered economically illiterate. So I'm wondering if you can comment on the status of economic education and literacy in America.
All right, so what I want to do is I want to hold, because we're running up against the break here. Let's pick that question up on the other side. And, John, I think it's a terrific point. And really, this may be our downfall if we don't straighten that out, because economic illiteracy is a disaster. It's a train wreck that we're in the middle of right now. The Shilling Show on WINA with David Morata, back right after the break. Stay with us.
It's The Shilling Show with Rob Shilling, only on WINA.
We're heading into the final segment for this hour. David Morata is our guest. 977-1070 is the phone number. We have a free large one-topping pizza for callers today from our friends at Domino's. Take advantage of it. And also, there are many questions remaining for David Morata, so if you have one, give us a call at 977-1070. Let's pick up where we left off with John's question about economic illiteracy and how serious is the problem in the United States.
The difficulty in the United States is I think we've kind of lost touch with some basic economics. And I'm not sure we've ever done a good job of it, because economics is called the dismal science.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the dismal science because it's very difficult to connect cause and effect and all of the unintended consequences for any kind of an action. So it is counterintuitive, but if I could put it into a soundbite, I'd say that freedom means less government, and less government means more freedom. And if you have that idea in mind, that is the primary basis. So you shouldn't look to the government to try to solve life's problems. Your first reaction shouldn't be there ought to be a law. Your first reaction ought to be what can I do to take care of my own needs and my own abilities. And that's the first rule of being a good citizen, is actually producing more than you consume and taking care of yourself, so that you have some largesse that you can share with others. And that's such a better philosophy. And so I think what we need today is we actually need people who might have an inkling of that and are willing to vote against what appears to be their self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
So we need more government workers who are willing to vote for smaller government, and we need more middle America that's willing to say, I am not going to burden my neighbor and my children with my needs. I'm going to take care of myself, and I'm going to take care of my children and my neighbor, rather than look to government solutions to do that. And I think that's the entrepreneurial spirit, that's the can-do America, and that's really what the founding fathers had in mind. You know, I think the founding fathers, if you read any of their works, they are about as rabid Tea Party members as you can get.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the inspiration. And it's unfortunate, David Morata, that what you have just described is exactly the opposite of what's being taught in state schools today, where people are graduating with their mouths open and their hands out and saying, basically, feed me, Seymour, if you ever saw Little Shop of Horrors. They're saying, feed me, Seymour, to the government, and just sitting there waiting for somebody to peel grapes and drop them in their mouths.
You know, we had something similar that happened in the 1970s. We had a terrible economic malaise. We had even Republicans like Nixon putting in wage and price
yeah.
controls and acting about a socialist socialistic as you can. And then we had Reagan in 1980 and the Reagan Revolution, and it looked like those ideas were gaining ascendancy.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan was kind of the last president who really really promoted those ideas, which is why a lot of conservatives look back and they want another Reagan Republican, and that has such traction. You know, now we've fallen back into more of a government solution. And it what strikes me is that the war of ideas and the marketplace of ideas is one that you have to constantly be working on in order to help people to see what is what is the cause and effect in economics. So Rob, I would say that your show is probably on the front lines of trying to make sure that these ideas are put before people, and they don't just blindly say, "Oh, that sounds like a good idea, so mm-hmm. government should do it and we should fund it." Because government does a lot of stuff incredibly ineffectually. In fact, I don't think there's anything that government does that private enterprise or private charities don't do at least two or three times better. And so we should just try to stop the idea of entitlement and get back to the idea of charity.
Let's go to the phones and say hello to Madison. Madison, welcome to the Shilling Show, and you're on with David Murata.
Yeah, well, my question is basically the idea that you talk about entitlement and the idea that you've created funds that you can cap and sell and trade these conservation credits that you've talked about on your show that you're trying to sell to other people, and it's not even really your tax break. You're selling something that's a piece of paper that's just a fake thing that's a discount. And if some farmer wants to put his land in conservation easement, I'm not even for that, but if he does, it should be his tax break and his alone. And the idea that it becomes something you can buy and sell, and then your firm can make a percentage profit off it, is just ludicrous.
Yeah, Madison, stay on the line for a minute. First of all, a couple of caveats. Our firm does not. We are not in the business of brokering tax credits. There are firms that do that, and you're right, they do make a little bit of a percentage off of it. Our firm purposefully doesn't make anything except for the fee that we charge our clients. We're a fee-only financial planner. Second, Madison, let me ask you this. If the government said they'd give you $10,000 to stand on your left foot for 2 minutes, would you do it?
Well, of course I would.
Okay. And that's exactly the same point that I'm in. I'm a financial planner and a wealth manager, and I'm trying to help my clients navigate the morass of government regulations and deals. And unfortunately, the tax code is filled with things. If you stand on your left foot for 2 minutes, we'll give you $10,000.
Right.
This happens to be one of them. What I do is I try to recommend that to my clients because it's an easy, you know, it's an easy $10,000. So if they have a $50,000 tax bill, they can buy $40,000 of tax credits. And anyone who's got a $50,000 tax bill is paying enough in taxes so that if I can save them $10,000, I try to do that. So
but the difference is that if somebody paid me the $10,000 stand on my left foot, I'd be up before Congress saying you shouldn't, you know, pay me the $10,000. Whereas tax planners and all these people are up there lobbying Congress. No, no, no! Don't do away with that law. Don't do away. That's how we make our money.
Right.
I'm 100%
with you. I am willing to help my clients take the Virginia tax credit deal, and then I vote against people who want to put lots of deals like that into legislation. So it's, and I think that's what we need more of. We need more people who, even the deals that they're getting, are willing to vote against their self-interest and try to vote those out of legislation. And you're right, that is a difficult thing to do. I remember that my very first mentor was surprised that a 21-year-old was for Reagan and was for conservative economics, even though I was unemployed and looking for a job and was being hard hit by a 35% unemployment in Eugene, Oregon. And he was surprised by that. And he said, you know, you of all people, a young person, ought to be in favor of the Democrats. And I said, but that's the wrong thing. And I will make my own way in the world, and I will ultimately be okay. And being unemployed for six, almost 9 months was okay, and it was hard, but it was the right thing to do because we needed to break the back of inflation. There are similar things we need to do today, and we all need to vote against it and advocate against it, even if we take advantage of things like the Virginia tax credits. If you think those are bad ideas, you need to vote against them. And you're right, a lot of tax manipulation like that produces special interests that then re-vote the people into office that support them. And I'm willing to bifurcate my I'll take advantage of them, and then I'll try to vote them out of office.
Yeah, I'm with you. And as I look at all of this call for taxing the rich and all that, you know, I don't covet their money. I don't want it. I don't want the government on my behalf or for me or my family taking more money from somebody else. It's time for all of us to just stop and say, enough is enough is enough. David Morata, thanks so much for joining us today. Direct people to your new blog as we head out in the final 20 seconds here.
Yeah, our blog is at www.moratonmoney.com. So it's moratonmoney.com.
Yeah, it's a terrific resource. And thank you so much for joining us today. As always, a great show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, David. Alrighty, I love it. I love it when people call in and challenge the host and challenge the guest, because these are important questions, and it really gave David, I think, a chance to clarify his own position in a way that we just didn't get to today. I knew that about David because I know him. I've heard him speak at various events and so forth, and I know what he's all about. He's really a libertarian at heart in many ways, and I think smaller government is something he'd love to see, including the elimination of a lot of these so-called loopholes. All right, The Shilling Show back after the break. Hey, if you've got something to say, we'll have a few minutes at the top of the hour. 977-1070.